I'm going to call to order Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. The first bill on the agenda is Representative Hillstrom, House File 571. Representative Hillstrom? Representative Hillstrom, would this go directly to the General Registry?
Transportation Finance.
Transportation, well, no, then it goes to Finance. So remember how it goes in is how it comes out, or it's some vague statement by Representative Carlson.
Great.
Representative Hillstrom, I will move that House File 571 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 571 is the best value bill for purchasing and contracting in Minnesota. We've been working with stakeholders, and we actually came to some agreement yesterday, but we don't have the amendment drafted in time to make your committee, so I'm having it copied so you at least can see what the agreements have been. The University of Minnesota has been using this, and they testified in a previous committee that they have saved 13%. On the buildings. It's been a pilot project, and we'd like to have the state be able to use it and local units of government as well. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to the test track.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Dick Anfang. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. The building and construction trades has long been aware of this option for contracting out construction projects, and we felt that it was worth a look at, it was worth getting educated on, and educating our legal staff to tell us more about it. And as they did that, we believe that they are very educated and knowledgeable about the option of best value contracting, and the exciting part about it for the construction trades is that we believe that we bring value to the construction industry. And at the end of the day, the folks that are best value contractors, certainly not every single one of them, there are some very good contractors out there that will rise to be best value, but this is an opportunity for us to show our best value to our train workers. With that, I'd like to introduce Rich Miller, who is our attorney, who has the nuts and bolts of the process as we've gone so far.
Right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Miller, and as Mr. Anfang stated, I am the attorney for the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. Under the leadership of Representative Hillstrom, we've spent a lot of time looking into and drafting what you have before you, in addition to working with stakeholders to reach the agreements that Representative Hillstrom mentioned earlier that will result in a document that you will soon see. The main purpose of this bill is to provide the state and its political subdivisions an option other than the typical traditional low bid system. The low bid system has certainly had its uses and is still useful and may be, under this bill, still used by the state and its political subdivisions. This bill does not purport to and does not do away with the low bid system. It provides another alternative. The legislature has in the past passed other bills that provide the Department of Administration and the Minnesota Department of Transportation with the ability to use different contracting methods, the design build legislation, the contractor at risk legislation, and the job order contracting legislation are similar tools that can be used. It does not, again, and I must emphasize, do away with the low bid system, and all political entities, including the Department of Administration, Minnesota Department of Transportation, will be entitled to, if they wish, continue to use the low bid, traditional low bid system. I also want to emphasize that this bill does not, and is not intended to, and does not constitute a union-only bill, even though it's sponsored by the state building trades, and we've been working very hard to get a bill similar to Representative Hillstrom's bill before the legislature. It levels the playing field. It provides an opportunity for a state agency to talk about something other than just the low bid, and is not designed to give the unions advantages or to cut out non-union employers. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and have you answer any questions.
Representative Hillstrom, I believe the potential amendment has just been passed out. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill, for or against? Yes, sir. Come on up. Welcome to the committee, and would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I can make very brief comments in support of House File 571. Cities already have some legal precedence for having the authority to do best value contracts. The Minnesota State Court of Appeals found that to be true in Westbrook Construction versus the City of Minnetonka in 2003. As long as the city very clearly lays out in advance the criteria that they will be using to score potential bidders and explains exactly how those priorities will be established and the criteria will be used in the decision. We think that this bill is an excellent step forward to put that into statute, clarify exactly how we should do this, and make it a more available tool for a broader range of local governments. And very much appreciate the author's work to improve this bill.
Mr. Johnson, have you had a chance to see the amendment? Did you work on this amendment with the author and the other?
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
I have not looked at this specific language yet, but yes, the League and many other groups have been involved in a stakeholder process to work on improving the language in the bill to tighten it up.
So, Mr. Johnson, you would then say that the League is supportive of this?
Mr. Chair, members, yes.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to comment that the Association of Minnesota Counties was not able to be here today, but they also have supported the bill.
Representative Hillstrom, do you know where the Coalition of Minnesota Cities is on this? That would be the other large entity that I would assume would have an interest in this. Yeah. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, the coalition has not taken any position on these sorts of bills. They have a fairly limited agenda that they work on, and this was not on their agenda, to the best of my knowledge.
Mr. Johnson, thank you. I'll remember the next time I see Tim Flaherty why they haven't taken a position on this.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I would be glad to point out that the League of Minnesota Cities is actually an umbrella organization. We do represent all the cities of the state. The coalition is a subset of those cities, but all of their members are already members of the League. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Hillstrom, do you have anyone else that you have to testify? Members, any questions of the author? Representative Emmer.
I have three specific questions, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hillstrom, first, you're adding the term proposal throughout. If you know, do you know why that's important, that it's not just bid?
Representative Emmer, are you going off the potential new language, or are you working off the bill?
I thought I was going off both.
All right.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can if you'd clarify it, this potential new language, does that eliminate everything else that was in here?
Representative Hillstrom, it was my understanding that this was a delete everything, wasn't it, or isn't it?
Mr. Chair, if I could defer.
Sure.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we've been working on amending the bill to take into account the comments made by all the stakeholders. And this latest iteration was really prepared last evening. It is intended to be a summary of the changes that have been proposed and that we believe will be introduced. We all obviously have to consult with Representative Hillstrom before a final draft is prepared. So what you have is what I believe is a summary of the changes.
So, Mr. Offing, this will be, or Representative Hillstrom, this will be a delete everything then, in all likelihood?
Mr. Chair, at the end it will all be a delete all. We're going to have another stakeholders meeting, and we need to make sure we get the bill in order.
And Mr. Vemmer, I'm just trying to clarify which one of these we're working off of, because if this is going to be all of the new language, then just so members know that your questions are in reference to one or the other. So go ahead, Representative Emmer.
And maybe it's not important if that's the case. Perhaps the gentleman could tell us if proposal's even going to be in the new one.
Mr. Offen?
I'm sorry, sir, I couldn't do it.
Representative, why don't you repeat exactly what your specific question is, and then I think either he could respond to it, or Mr. Miller, or Mr. Johnson.
In the actual original language of House File 571, you add proposal or proposals everywhere that you've got the term bid. For instance, Section 8 on page 3, you add or proposals, so it reads bids or proposals. All I was asking is that how's that important? Why is it different?
Mr. Alton?
Mr. Chairman, the term proposal is in there because we are now enabling the public entity to send out requests for proposals. And so the response would then be a response to that or a proposal rather than a bid. So we wanted to change the language to be consistent.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, probably as you know, cities can already do requests for proposals in certain kinds of projects, and they have to do the lowest responsible bid in others. And so much of best value really goes back to looking a lot like a request for proposal. And so people can come in with your specifications, and they can say, we can give you X for what you're asking for, and it may be better than the minimum standards, and that is the beauty of best value, and that's the reason the University of Minnesota has saved 13%.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, okay, so then the second question, you've answered part of it, but one of the testifiers said this was a bill to level the playing field. Isn't it an important piece of legislation from the standpoint that the bidder or the entity making the proposal, whether it's union or not, can still be accepted even though they're going to have a higher bid than the lowest bid?
Representative Hillstrom?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, that is correct. And actually, the University of Minnesota, in their proposals, testified, I think they ended up picking the same contractor that they would have picked if it was just straight lowest responsible bidder more than 54% of the time, I think they said.
Thanks.
Representative Emmer, you had a couple other questions at
that. No, I think that was it. The last one I was going to ask is if we've already had this determined in Westwood versus the city of Minnetonka, why is it important that we do this?
Maybe Mr. Offing or who else? Mr. Johnson had alluded to a court case on this, if he's still here.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
If I may, there are two things that are at play here. Number one, it is difficult for any municipal organization to rely completely on the Wester case because it really does nothing more than to define in one specific instance, in one specific case, what a municipality may do in determining a responsible bidder. What the legislation is intended to do is to, as I said, make a more level playing field, that is, that there will be a process that the municipality may use to consider something other than the low bid. The low bid will no longer be just, well, it can be in some circumstances if low bid is a process that's used, but under the best value system, that will not be the sole determining factor of who is entitled to receive the bid.
Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It also would allow the Department of Administration to use it, MnDOT if they so chose, school boards, those kinds of things as well.
Representative Emmer.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's why I'm asking. There is an instance that I'm aware of in the Department of Administration in granting a certain a contract where they did not take the low bidder. So I thought this was already being done across the board. That's why I was asking the questions.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of tag-teaming on what Representative Emmer is talking about, this is in effect a way of defining what responsible means and gives local municipalities some cover when they decide, make it easier for them to pick a bidder that may not be the lowest bidder, but from their track record or whatever, has proved that they can perform the work that they're bidding on. Is that correct, or?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as the community has identified ahead of time what they're going to be judging the criteria under, You can't send out and say you're going to take the lowest responsible bidder and then come up with criteria after. I mean, we want to make certain that if people are using this, that they are laying out what is expected ahead of time to make it fair.
All right. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I like what you're doing. I think we need to inject more conversations about value for taxpayers along the way. But there's a couple things I'm concerned about in the new language that was handed out. I'm concerned about how a city judges the business practices of these contractors. Specifically, I'm looking at the language that best value criteria could be the contractor's ability to minimize change orders, the contractor's ability to prepare project plans, technical capacities, ability to assess and minimize risk. I'm wondering how a city can make those judgments about how a contractor does business. It seems to me that might be opening the city up in a way that I don't think either you or they would intend.
Who wishes to respond to that one?
I was looking to see if the city was still on the road.
Is Mr. Johnson still here, League of Cities? He is not here. Mr. Offing.
If I may, Mr. Chairman. What we're defining here is not a step-by-step procedure, but a process. And one of the early steps in the process is for the entity to engage contractors in the process to determine whether or not they would like to compete in a best value situation. And then contractors, and anybody can do this. There's no pre-qualification. Anybody can do it. It isn't a matter whether you've done business for the city or the county or the other agency before. That's not on the agenda. Whether you want to participate, if you want to participate, then the first thing that you are requested to do as a contractor is to provide the entity with a recommendation or recommendations from previous persons that you've worked for. They could be state agencies. They could be private agencies. So the determination is early made whether or not other work that you've done has been, at least with respect to the owner, satisfactory. So that's the initial process. And as we go through this process, there are other markers to determine what is the ability, determine the abilities and skills of the contractor. But the contractor always has input. That's part of their response to the request for proposal. The proposal will contain detailed information that is going to be considered by the entity, whether it's a city or the state, in selecting the best value contractor. So it is a process, and one of the other things that some of the stakeholders have recommended, and I think Representative Hillstrom agrees, is that there should be some training that is provided, and I'm looking at the Department of Administration, their representative now, and they are large agencies. They have engaged in similar processes, and so we think that the training is necessary here and probably should come through an agency such as the Department of Administration, to help the smaller entities, the school boards and the cities and counties, become accustomed to the process. It's a crawl, walk, run process. We're not just going to jump into it and immediately require everybody to become experts in best value contracting. There obviously is a necessity to go slow and to learn the process because it is new. So we're talking about cliffs. We're talking, that is, restricting certain best value contracting to certain agencies in the initial stages, and then having one or two, three phase in of the process and provide for training, so that there is a process that we end up with that is uniform throughout the state, that is open and transparent, and designed to get the taxpayers the best bang for their buck, get the best project that we possibly can get under the circumstances. That's the end goal.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up. I don't think this is the intent, but I'm wondering about smaller contractors, and if, with the language that I just read to you, if this fences them out of their, if they don't maybe have the capacity in-house, but maybe contracted out in terms of the plan preparation and other technical things, does that fence them out?
Mr. Offing.
Mr. Chairman, no. We believe, and I think that's been the experience at the University of Minnesota, that smaller contractors are included. You include not only the small contractors, but also the subcontractors that those small contractors may use. So it's designed to be very open and not to exclude anyone. Anybody can participate in it.
anyone can participate, and it's you're not graded on previous projects with that entity unless you performed one for them before and not done a particularly good job. And that may be a bit of a problem. But then and there are criticisms with that too. We heard from the from Minsky saying, well, we have in some of our colleges we have people who are really tough graders, and in one college that person may the same contractor doing the same job could get a 5, and then in the next college the same contractor, same type of quality work, can get a 10. So we have another issue here. We have to work through all of these issues, and we're bound and determined to do that, and certainly the building trades. And I know Representative Hillstrom is dedicated to making sure that this is a fair, open process that does not exclude but encourages newer and startup corporations to participate in the process.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I agree with the concept of this bill. I heard this in another committee, which was helpful. But, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, since we have this new language that's not in amendment form and it's not finalized and we won't be able to have the opportunity to actually vote on the amendment itself, wouldn't it be better that we give the author the opportunity to get this in amendment form and we can maybe hear this bill tomorrow?
Representative Anderson, we're under an extremely tight timeline. I believe the number of bills that could be heard by this committee is somewhere in the neighborhood of 220. The amendment is here, and in the best of all worlds, yes, I would have preferred that, but it is going to finance, and the thrust of this bill is a financial thrust. So under a best world situation, given we're on deadlines, this is the best we're going to do with this bill today. You don't need to vote for it, Representative Anderson.
Well, I'm just a little concerned, Mr. Chair, about the process overall. I just don't want to have us later on being accused of avoiding what the proper process is for hearing bills and amendments in the format they're supposed to be heard in.
Well, Representative Anderson, the motion is to send this to finance, where it will go down to, where would it go from finance?
Transportation.
Transportation finance. So it has got several stops along the way. Yet. And they are still working on it. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only brought this proposed compromise so that you would be aware of it. I'm fine with my bill the way that it was. And we are attempting to work with stakeholders, and so this is making the bill better. Again, I introduced it as proposed, and I've been happy to have it be law as it was. But
members, if it adds anything, this committee has been inundated with suggestions. I would consider this a suggestion and not an amendment, and we'll take it as a suggestion as the bill may or may not move forward, depending on how the committee votes. Very detailed suggestion, I might add. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 571 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hillsman.
Thank you.
House File 1206. Oops, wait a second. I think we do have at least one or two motions here. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I do have perhaps up to three, but maybe we can deal with them all in one. I'd like to move the minutes from last week, March 13, March 14, and March 15.
Any discussion to Representative Morgan's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Morgan. Representative Kelleher, House File 1206. I will move that House File 1206 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Kelleher, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today before you is House File 1206, and I'll try to go fast. I know you have a lot of bills to hear in your next, in your hearing today and your other hearings. So Minnesota is at the bottom five of states that identify babies with hearing loss. We are classified by the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, as having unsatisfactory performance in this area. This bill would require hospitals to conduct screenings on all newborns and report the results to the Department of Health. This would bring the number of babies that are identified with hearing loss from 64 yearly to 240. So you can kind of see the need for the bill. We have a very serious either under-reporting or non-reporting situation in the state. And the reason why this is important is that studies show that babies who are screened within 1 month of birth and have their hearing loss confirmed and by hearing loss confirmed by 3 months and intervention within 6 months, they have normal social, emotional, language, and cognitive development. If they don't have that opportunity, or their families don't have that opportunity, the gap is almost impossible to make up. Children who do not have that screening done actually often get to the age of 18 with an average reading level of third grade. It's a very serious issue. The Early Hearing Detection Advisory Committee, the reason the bill has come before you today, will advise the Minnesota Department of Education and the Minnesota Department of Health and develop the medical and educational guidelines that are based on evidence-based practices. You have before you, in your packet, I believe, an example of the Advisory Council in Colorado's work, which is quite extensive, but puts in one place all the educational and medical information that people would need in doing screenings and interventions. And one of the things that I think is important for this committee, I heard the last bill, and I think it's interesting that we are fairly certain that we are not getting our value out of the programming that's out there for deaf and hard of hearing young Minnesotans, that there's actually a lot of money left on the table, and that we're not properly utilizing those resources. And we have support on this bill from many consumer groups, including the Minnesota Association of Deaf and Deaf Citizens, the Minnesota Hospital Association, Ready for K, the Hearing Loss Association of America, Minnesota Nurses Association, and Minnesota Academy of Audiologists. I also want to acknowledge that Representative Kahn has taken a keen interest in this bill over the years, and I want to thank her for that. I'm going to turn it over to Mary Hartnett, who is with the Minnesota Commission for Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. About 10 years ago, we came before the legislature trying to get a mandate for hearing screening passed. We've had a voluntary system in place. Great people have come together from the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, the Department of Education to try to create a system that's been successful for all children and families in the state. Unfortunately, the results are that we're screening and reporting a fraction of those kids, just a fraction or a small portion of the kids that we should be identifying. As Representative Kelleher mentioned, when we provide intervention to these kids, once they're identified, there's very little gap between their chronological age and their language development. We are here to ask for your support. We have a stakeholder group that we put together that is probably puts everybody, there's about 20 members here, and all of them said they wanted to be part of this process. And part of the model for this is comes from many other states that have put together advisory councils. If we have a product or come up with a product that is close to one that the speaker mentioned, we will really have a good system in this place that will be seamless and have all stakeholders at the table, creating evidence-based recommendations to the Department of Health and the Department of Education.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing no one, seeing no questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 1206 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Bill's on its way.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
members. Representative Emmer, you finally made it. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Simon. I'm sorry. I was ready to go with you, Representative Emmer. Where is Representative Simon? Is he even here? Oh, he's here. Too bad.
Here, I almost feel
just like since Simon has had so many bills, I couldn't imagine one more could be needed. But
Mr. Chairman, we agree.
Yeah. Representative Simon, go ahead. Sorry about that, Representative Emery. I was ready to go there. And Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'll try to make this so we can get to the main event, Representative Emery's bill. But House File 548 deals with professional and technical service contracts. Once in a while, a state employee is laid off. And when that state employee is laid off in this area, they're put on a recall list. And all that this bill says is that for a period of time after the layoff, the state must, in the case of certain contracts, certify that a person on that recall list is available for the work. Otherwise, the state may not contract it out. That's really the bill, but to discuss the nuances, I'm going to turn it over to a testifier who can help explain the details.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Richard Kajewski. I am the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. All this bill really does is when an agency wants to lay off individuals, whether it be for lack of money, lack of work, or other reasons that layoffs do occur, they can't later on outsource that work without recalling them while they're actually on the layoff list. That period of time could be anywhere up to 4 years. What it doesn't do is prevent the Department of Administration from administering the approximately 5,000 contracts that they administer today. This language makes it an agency responsibility. Senate staff has determined there's no fiscal impact. No agency should be impacted if they do not have the intent to outsource work for the jobs that they have laid off specifically. So that's it in a nutshell, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. And I apologize. I believe you do have a delete everything amendment, Representative Simon, and perhaps you want to put the bill into shape first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the DE1 amendment, which is the delete all.
All right. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill then should be in order. So to the bill as amended. Representative Conn.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, you know, it actually seems a little limited because it's only limited to the agency. Seems, let's look at an agency that lays off, you know, some kind of receptionist staff or something like that, and then outsources that. It seems to me there may be other people throughout state government. Did anyone talk about using a statewide layoff list?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn. I agree with that the problem or the issue is broader than this. Absolutely. This bill just seeks to deal with this narrow slice of life in state government, and maybe that's for another time. I agree with you that it's an issue that goes beyond the scope of just this bill. I don't know if Mr. Jaskie wants to.
Mr. Jaskie, you want to address that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think what you said is accurate. I would agree with that.
Representative Kahn.
We're supposed to have, you know, it doesn't seem to me as if it's that much more trouble. We're supposed to have statewide state government wide employment tests, state government wide lists and so forth. I don't understand why it's a problem to expand this beyond the agency. And I don't know if that's questions been asked of DOOR or administration or whatever, but no, I'm obviously not going to make an amendment now, but I just think we ought to ask that and fix it now instead of come back with a year later with another broadening of it.
Mr. Kajewski, you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I think part of the answer to your question, there is a statewide recall list, I think, is what you're alluding to. And the other piece, this language has been offered because of the concern our employees have in the IT field, specifically. I think we've seen on the governor's website has a quote under principles, we will encourage competition, collaboration, privatization, outsourcing, and the increased use of technology and e-government services to improve the work we do. I think the press conference regarding the governor's trade mission to India was a major concern of our employees when they saw the state Gopal Khanna, the state CIO, standing next to the governor. I think that's a concern, and this piece of language doesn't prevent layoffs at all. It doesn't prevent the contracts that the state currently engages in. It's just a preventative measure, if you will. I'm not aware that it's even happened in state service. But it is a major concern that we're hearing from a lot of professional employees, especially in that field.
Person Brett. Person Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple of questions. One, what's the magic of 4 years? And number two, especially in the technology field, in IT in particular, that rolls over and changes so quickly that an employee who's not working in that field and is out for 4 years, if has not been in the technology area, are not they potentially behind the curve technology? And then I'll follow up later.
Representative Simon or Mr. Kucheski?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the significance of the 4 years is that it's currently in the collective bargaining agreement today. To answer your other question, I think the IT people of the state of Minnesota are continuously going through training, and I think what you say is right. It's a continuing field that changes on a regular basis. I think the state does provide training to those employees. I think those employees do keep up with times. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Rev. Sim Peterson.
Not quite. Thank you. But if you've laid them off in a technical area, and they're out of the mix now for 4 years, I would suggest that the technology in the state is so advanced in that 4 years that how do they come back into a management position and pick up without pulling down the technology of the entire unit?
Either Rep. Simpson or Mr. Kucheski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm certainly not an IT expert. I hear your concern, and I can't tell you if it's valid or not.
Rep. Simpson.
Well, I think let's go to Ryan first.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, it's based on my experience in the IT world, if you're hiring somebody with similar skills, say in programming, you have to be familiar with a particular programming language or you would not be considered to be qualified for the role. So they don't just say generally, are there any computer programmers out there that we could hire that could do this job? That's not really the question. It's much more specific to the type of technology involved. And that's the way the industry is evolving more and more over time, that you have to be tied into the particular type of project that is going to be done or the type of platform that you're working on in order to be able to say that you are qualified to do that particular job. And in general, most of the programmers I know, certainly, and network engineers spend a great deal of time being aware of what's going on in their field at the time because they know that's the only way they can get any kind of job in that area. I think if they left that for 4 years and weren't keeping up with coming developments, they were obviously not intending to be in that field any longer and probably would not be interested in the job at all.
All right, members, before we proceed here, Representative Simon, when you made your motion, where was this bill to go to? Or did you make your motion?
Yeah.
I thought you had, but...
No, this should, I think, just go off to the General Register. There's no official note on it.
Mr. Shepard? All right. And I thought you'd made your motion, so then we adopted the amendment. We weren't adopting it really to anything. But I'll have to withdraw that motion since we didn't have the bill before. So why don't you move your bill first? Let's get that done.
Mr. Chair, I move that the bill be passed and be referred to the General Register.
All right. So that motion's before us, and then let's go with the amendment, and let's move the amendment to that motion. All those in favor, then Representative Simon moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. All right. Now we're in order. And then to the question, on page 2 of your amendment, Representative Simon, there is language that apparently goes to the issue of who's going to be considered here. You want to address the language that's on page 2, lines 2.8 through 2.10?
Right.
That at least seems to get at the level of competency and consideration. Mr. Orsen, Simon.
Well, I agree. You put your finger on it, Mr. Chair. Those lines, 2.8 through 2.10, do give quite a bit of discretion to the agency to discuss what the minimum qualifications are. And in the hypotheticals we've been discussing here, I would imagine if a particular job pertains to knowledge or expertise in a particular area, and if that employee on the recall list just doesn't know the area by virtue of having been out of the field or out of the agency for a while, certainly that would not hamstring the agency in any way.
Representative Member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think, Representative Simon, I think Representative Winkler's point was excellent when I read your language. It raised a concern with me, and maybe it's already covered. If you'd address it, he was talking about in the field, which I don't know very well, but apparently he does, the folks have to be qualified for the specific application, if I'm interpreting it right. But you've got language in here that says minimum qualifications. Based on what Representative Winkler was addressing, could you explain to me or clarify if this will cause an agency some problems, if there's a minimum, which would be knowing how to turn the machine on, or that's what I'm qualified for. That's what I'm qualified for. But you see where I'm going, based on what Representative Winkler said. I'd like some clarity that this does give the agency the ability to do exactly what it was he's pointing out.
Yeah, absolutely, Simon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Member, fair question. And I think the language, at least as I read it, minimum qualification, that floor could be anywhere. It could be turning on the machine, but it could be intimate knowledge of application XYZ. And if the employee who's been off of state service or on a recall list for 3.5 years out of the 4 doesn't know what the heck application XYZ is, that would be up to the agency to define, that's all. This just gives the person on a recall list who meets criteria a fair crack, a fair shake at the job. But if they don't know what they're talking about, if by virtue of being out of the industry, they don't know what they're talking about, or they're just way behind the times, I would imagine the agency could set the bar pretty high then.
Representative Hammer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon and the testifier, maybe removing the word minimum might be an option at some point. But I'm not going to make the amendment. I just think based on the comments that were made earlier, it might make sense. Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr.
Chair, Representative Emmer. I think every job in the state of Minnesota has minimum qualifications that are fairly specific. And I think nearly all job classes are available up on the DUER website with job specs. So I think that probably speaks closer to the minimum qualifications for a job than probably anything else as a general term. In addition, I think there are jobs in the state of Minnesota, and we see it with layoffs, that are so specific that you may have the same classification, but you don't have the same class option. Therefore, you may not have the qualifications and the requirements to actually meet that job requirement. And in a layoff situation, for instance, you can't bump down into that position because you're not qualified to do it.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my understanding of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is to prevent an agency of the state to lay off a bunch of people, then the next year say, well, we need a bunch of people doing the same jobs that we laid all these people off for, but we can't find anyone to do it, so we're going to subcontract this work out or outsource these jobs, and it's protect these employees that are on layoff. Give them the ability to come back and do those jobs if they're qualified to do it. I'm thinking back, I mean, it's one of I sit on the transportation department, and they talk a lot of times about with the spikes in the trough sometimes of the construction, of the road construction work, that MnDOT is saying that they're having trouble having enough engineers on to do this, and so therefore they have to outsource this, and that's their excuse they use. But if they would have, say, half their staff on layoff, they would have to call those people back before they could then outsource all that work, because they've got qualified people there to do the work that are sitting on layoff. Am I correct in that? Am I correct in that assumption, or
Mr. Kucheski?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Any further discussion? Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Nelson. That's exactly why I'm not so sure why there's no fiscal note on this. If the state has some flexibilities It just seems to me that there's got to be some type of fiscal impact on the state. But, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a suggestion. I have an amendment that I hope Representative Simon, right. Simon will look at. We heard in the first bill a lot of talk about best value and making sure we're getting the best bang for the taxpayer dollar, and I strongly supported Representative Hillstrom's bill while having some concern about the specific language. So I hope that Representative Simon will accept some simple language, and if the language goes on, I think we probably can redefine and define it a little bit better. But after agency on line 2.10, add the sentence, the agency may make a decision based on best value.
Representative Brug, let's have Mr. Shepherd make sure that it works first. So, Mr. Shepherd, what is the amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding of Representative Broad's amendment would be on page 2, line 10, after the period, to insert, the agency may make a decision based on best value.
Representative Sen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would respectfully oppose the amendment for a couple of reasons. I think that the best value criteria that we heard in the other bill, it's a little bit apples and oranges here. I think that as defined in that bill, it's a little bit of a different concept and a term of art. And also, I believe, and I understand Representative Broad's concern or her intent here, but my read of it is that on the DE1 amendment, lines 1.7 and 1.8, probably get rid of that concern. There's some real broad language in there already in current law that talk about one of the criteria being whatever is necessary and reasonable to advance the statutory mission of the agency. That's already one of the criteria. So if something other than cost, other than purely low cost, is essential or meets that language, that seems to solve that problem. And I get where you're going, Representative Broad. That we want to get value, and it's not always a question of money or the bottom line. But I think that comfort language, at least from my standpoint, you may disagree, seems to be getting at the concern. And I'd hate to bring in another term of art, even though we just discussed it and it's all on our mind right now. I don't know that it necessarily belongs.
Representative Brock.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. We're still on the broad amendment. Representative Kahn, to the amendment.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just think that's absolutely ridiculous, the thought that you could apply best value to people. I mean, how would you decide the best value between me and Representative Broad, for example?
Mr. Chair, I can answer that question if you wish.
It would depend whether you wanted rocks or softballs thrown.
Sound it, Mr. Chair?
I'm ready to vote. We have
yes. clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Broad?
Yes.
Representative Emmer?
Yes.
Representative Hilsey?
No.
Representative Hollis?
No.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Salem?
No.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Coffey?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Winkler?
No.
Representative Goldschmacher?
No.
Seeing the 11 no's and 4 ayes, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. To the bill is amended. Seeing no more discussion, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 548 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Now, Representative Emmer, you are on.
You can. Or I call you. I think, what did I do now?
That's right. Representative Emmer, I'm Where do you wish this bill to go?
Well, House File 729, I'd move to have it passed to the General Register.
All right. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House File 729, I'll dub the Clean Government Bill. I'll quickly explain the bill, and then I'll give you the genesis of where it comes from. What the bill does, it's very self-explanatory. It prohibits the state of Minnesota from doing business with certain contractors or vendors who have been convicted or have committed certain specific crimes of theft, embezzlement, forgery, dishonesty. Probably the unique language in the bill is it includes vendors who have, in order to avoid prosecution and conviction, entered into settlement agreements where they have paid $1 million or more. In the words of one Department of Administration employee, if you paid $1 million or more, there's obviously something wrong. The bill goes on to talk about terminating the contracts with someone, and there's a look back currently in the bill of 3 years. I understand that that might be amended, and I'm open to that if that's offered. Now, a little bit of where this comes from. When I first was elected a couple of years ago, I got involved with the special transportation issue. Some have heard of the issue, some have not. But essentially, the state had entered into an agreement with a broker to broker special transportation services to certain citizens. That broker was a company out of St. Louis, Missouri. Essentially, if I could just streamline the process, they had said, we have a pot of money. We're going to, because of anticipated growth, we've got to figure out ways to save money. So we're going to institute that we've got providers that are delivering a service out of this pot of money. We are now going to bring in a broker who's going to be a middleman to set up the ride between the transportation folks and the clients or the patients. We're going to do it out of the same money. Somehow that was supposed to have saved money for the state. I don't believe that it did, and I will rely on the facts that it didn't. But in the process of getting involved in that, I was involved with certain other members of the House in asking for the Department of Health to send out a request for proposal on the brokering contract a little bit more than a year ago. The broker involved, and I'll tell you, this is not a personal issue to that broker, but I give you, because the issue goes well beyond this one experience. I'm telling you why it is that I'm sitting before you as opposed to somebody else. But we went through that entire process, or the department did, and despite not being the lowest bidder, despite having all kinds of other issues outside of the state of Minnesota, which I have some folks here that will testify and give you some background, I think upwards of $20 million in settlement in Missouri, problems in Ohio and New York, we entered into the same contract administratively with this same vendor. That's wrong. Minnesota citizens expect more than that, and this bill would ensure that we are only hiring vendors that are of the quality and character that we would expect to hire if it were you or I entering into the contract. Mr. Chairman, there was an amendment, and there might be some discussion about that. I do not intend to offer the amendment, but I'm going to give a little background, and I'd like to make an amendment to my bill.
All right.
To try and assist with that. This was on the calendar last week. The night before it was going to be heard, the Department of Administration sent a couple of folks to see me, and they suggested that they can do this in rulemaking authority, and they went ahead and drafted an amendment that would have required them to modify their rules to address this specific situation. Two things. One, I think under the Department of Administration rules, they can already address this situation. But two, I had no problem with the stronger language, more clarity as to what they could
they call them debar, what they could debar a vendor for. But overnight, as I started looking into it, it turns out that if you're going to go through the rulemaking process, it can delay the proceeding for up to 2 years. So the next day, I told the chairman that I did not want to go that route. I would prefer to put this into law as soon as possible. And in order to cooperate and work with the Department of Administration, I would move the following amendment.
All right, Representative Emmer.
I would move to add at the end of the bill, after line 2.26, a subdivision 4, which would be a repealer, and it would state this section is repealed June 30, 2009.
All right, Representative Emmer, let's take it just a little bit slow so we can have Mr. Shepard. Do you have that, Mr. Shepard? You want to tell us exactly what this does?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Emmer's amendment would go at the very end of the bill and would just would add a new subdivision 4 with a headnote repeal that would say this section is repealed June 30th, 2009. So the entire section would only exist for 2 years.
All right. So, Representative Emmer, you're adding a sunset to the bill.
I am, Mr. Chairman. And again, the purpose is to cooperate with the Department of Administration. That would give them 2 years to put this into their rules formally. Up to 2 years. In the meantime, we would have a basis to ensure the quality and character of our vendors.
Right. Any discussion to the Emmer Amendment? Representative Morgan has been on the list to the amendment. Representative Morgan? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, I appreciate your coming forward with this bill. I haven't had a chance to talk to the Department of Administration on this. Are you confident that they will work in good faith to make sure that they take care of this in their rulemaking process before June 30th, 2009?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I take them at their word. They represented to me that's something they would do. Perhaps if they're here, they can clarify that on the record, but that's my understanding.
Representative Winkler.
Sorry, not to the amendment.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Kahn.
Well, it's not exactly to the amendment, but I don't see the
Representative Kahn, but can we just stay with the amendment for a second,
well,
though?
Well, it's related to what's been said about the amendment. I don't see the rulemaking process in the bill. Do I see that anywhere?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, no, you do not.
Well,
Representative Emmer was referring to an amendment that had been brought forward last week.
Well, that's why, Mr. Chairman, the conversation doesn't make any sense. I mean, the reason we're avoiding rules is to put it in, which I think I commend Representative Emmer in doing that. I wish more legislators would do that instead of leaving to rules. But then there was some comment about looking at the agency that do rules in good faith in two years, and that's not, you know, there's nothing in here that tells them that they're going to do rules, and I hope that they don't have the authority to do rules on anything unless we tell them to.
Representative Miller.
So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, that actually is an excellent suggestion, and had the amendment been in the packet that I had this morning, I probably could have moved that as an amendment to this bill as well. But it's not. So if you prefer, whatever the will of the committee is, I would be happy to withdraw my amendment and save that for a later date. Or we can, if you'll do me the courtesy, if you agree with me and we move this out of the committee, I would work with the Department of Administration to make sure that that's incorporated.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my preference is actually to do it in statute, unless there's something wrong with this. You know, one of the reasons why we meet every year is we can correct things that we did that isn't right, so that if the, and I don't care whether it has a sunset or not, that's fine, because it means we look at it then. But what I was objecting to was the statement that the agency can then work on rules. What you would want the agency to do is to look at, see at how the statute is working, and then come in with changes to do it. So I was just picking up on your
Emmer,
comment.
We still have the amendment before us, members, so we're still dealing with the amendment. All those in favor of the Emmer amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails, the amendment is adopted. Representative Emmer, we have no formal rules for this committee, as you understand. We have operative rules, and one of the operative rules is the Senate companion. Representative Emmer, is there a Senate companion to this bill?
Yes, there is.
Representative Emmer, who is the chief author of the Senate companion?
I think there are some folks that are here. why don't I have them testify? They can tell you who's carrying it in the Senate.
All right. I was hoping that the Senate author might be here for a photo op, but go ahead. Sit down. Tell us who the Senate author is, if you would.
Mr. Chairman,
Michael Widener. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota Medical Transportation Coalition. Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty is the sole author.
If anybody needs to clear their throat at this point.
All right, Mr. Widener, to the bill as amended. Do you wish to testify to the bill, or are you just giving us that bit of information?
No, I'll testify to the bill.
Although that is a significant piece of information. Perhaps historic. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just need one additional fact to go along with that. Who started the bill and asked the other person to be the chief of?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, the reason that Mr. Widener's here is that I had expressed some... I'll choose my words carefully, over the last year in working with the special transportation issue, I had expressed some very strong frustration and dissatisfaction by the fact that we were just following the same path that I thought was mistaken. Someone in Mr. Widener's organization actually, after I suggested we should have some type of a rule that would prevent us from doing business with folks that have been convicted or have paid these large settlements, took it upon themselves to move forward with the idea and then brought it to me. And my understanding is that they approached Senator Marty, although I will tell the chair and Representative Kahn, I gladly would have done it. I've worked with Senator Marty on other issues, including campaign finance reform. So, and we both throw rocks, I think.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, I'm looking at line 1.11, states there that they can't do business with a company, and then it states on lines 1.16 and 1.17 who've committed embezzlement, theft, forgery, bribery, falsification, destruction of records, making false statements, or receiving stolen property. Wouldn't it be, and maybe this is implied in the company, but wouldn't it be more applicable to officers or owners or directors of a company that have committed those particular crimes, as opposed to the corporate entity itself?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you make an excellent point. I will note that it says company or entity. If you're suggesting that we should add and officers or employees, the problem is I didn't want to get into that. You start going into employees. If you own the company, you know, how far down does it go? And that was the problem. Plus, you may have an officer who's doing something that's separate. You know, the company's not paying that settlement. So,
right. Mr. Chair, I agree. But then I'm wondering how enforceable Subdivision 1.3 really is, since it would be difficult to convict a company of many of those particular crimes. You know, maybe we could say officers or directors or owners.
Owners. Emmer. I'm open to any amendment that Representative Winkler has in that regard. I would accept that.
Representative Winkler, you want to work on something and then give it to Mr. Shepard, if you would, so we could have it? Or do you have something right now?
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment I'd like to move.
All right. Representative Winkler has an amendment. Where do you wish to amend the bill?
Line 1.11, after company, insert a comma, and the words, or its officers, directors, or beneficial owners, comma.
Mr. Shepard, do you have that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do, and I might need to just work with Representative Winkler for a minute on the grammar of that. I understand the concept. It's hard to amend in this, the way the bill is laid out right here.
Representative Winkler, you want to withdraw the amendment with the understanding Mr. Shepard's working on it, and we can come back to it when we have the language as we need it? Instead of working back and forth right now, we might want to have some other questions. So why don't you withdraw the amendment?
I withdraw the amendment.
And then we'll have it proposed once the language form will be worked out. Representative Morgan, I believe, has another amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's a little bit easier to handle, and I would like to thank Representative Emmer for suggesting that we lengthen that look-back period. I think that that would make this bill stronger, and my amendment would be to extend the 3-year look-back to a 5-year look-back. So on line 1.11, change 3-year to 5-year. Also,
yes.
On line 2.1, change 3-year to 5-year. And on line 2.15, change 3-year to 5-year.
Representative, Representative Morgan, you're moving that amendment.
I am moving that amendment.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I suggested it, but somebody was talking about it, and I'm entirely open to it. I'd accept that, and if you'd like, I'd incorporate it.
I think what we'll do at this point is just offer it as a separate amendment. I've got the bill before us, and now it's amendable. So, any further discussion to Representative Morgan's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kalin? No.
Okay.
Oh, Representative Simon.
Oh, it's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Emmer, I also have, I want to ask you about something that may turn into an actual amendment, Mr. Chair, rather than a suggestion. But I'm wondering why the line, for example, 1.14, why the bad conduct is limited to just public transactions. I would suggest, and I'm ready to amend the bill so that we get rid of the words public and then the parenthetical. So it's anyone who's been convicted or had a civil judgment rendered against them on performing a transaction or contract, regardless of whether it's public.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, the question, someone put this together for me initially, but on reading it, since we're dealing with public contracts, I left the language alone. I'm entirely, I'm fine. If that's an amendment you want to move, I would accept it.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, then I will move the following verbal amendment. On line 1.14, strike the words public and the following parenthetical. And make the same change, Mr. Chair, on lines 2.5 and 2.19.
Mr. Shepard, can you, first of all, Mr. Shepard, do you have that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. As I understand Representative Simon's amendment, it would be to delete the words public and then the parenthetical expression federal, state, or local. On lines 1.14 and on lines 2.19.
And Mr. Shepard, is there any is there any problem with doing that? Does it ripple anywhere else in the bill that we would need to do it?
Mr. Chair, there's one more place on line 2.5. Thank you, Representative Kalin.
All right, 2.5.
And no, I don't think it ripples. I think that that works in the bill.
Any discussion to the Simon Amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Are we ready yet with the Winkler amendment? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, up to a point. In discussion with Mr. Shepard, he suggested that I just go forward with the language I suggested and that we may need to work through this section of the bill to clarify and put it together in the right order. But for now, I'll offer language that would do that. And so my amendment would be on line 1.11, after entity, insert a comma, and then the words including officers, comma, directors, or beneficial owners, comma.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Winkler, yes, I believe that that works correctly. As I noted earlier, some of the way the grammar of this whole paragraph works together, I might need to work with Representative Emmer later to make sure that that it works correctly, but I believe the amendment is fine.
Mr. Shepherd, is that the only place in the bill we would need to make that change? I don't see another place.
Mr. Chair, I believe it might need a similar amendment on 2.2 because we're requiring a certification that's parallel to the language on line 1.1.
I'm looking at 2.2. What would be added on line 2.2?
Mr. Chair, I think that the same language would be added after the word applicant on line 2.1.
All right.
The same thing that Representative Winkler added, and then also, Mr. Chair, on line 2.15, the same language would be added after the word entity there. I will write this all up for Ms. Anderson.
All right. Are the members clear what the various places this would have to go to change the bill? Representative Winkler, are you comfortable with the way it's going to be changed?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Emmer?
Let's vote.
Representative Kalin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Representative Winkler or the bill's author. I'm just wondering if we're casting the net too wide with the specific placement and structure of the amendment, whether a director, a beneficial owner, or officer has violated any of the four clauses on page one and subdivision one for reasons that have nothing to do where I'm going, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Palin, I think that would fall under the rotten apple spoils the barrel theory, and that we don't need spoiled barrels performing state contracts.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to refrain from the...
It'd be a good point to stop.
I'm going to refrain from the American and apple pie metaphors and speak with Representative Winkler about the specific structure after committee.
All those in favor of Representative Winkler's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Member, do you have any other changes to the bill? There are people who wish to testify. We didn't say that they could come.
I do not. I think we have several people, including Mr. Widener, who would like to testify.
Mr. Widener, do you want to testify to the bill as amended now? Are you here?
Yes, I would. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I am, as I earlier indicated, I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association, and we are part of the Medical Transportation Coalition, which includes the Ambulance Association, the EMS Association, the Special Transportation Association, and the Paramedics Association. As Representative Emmer said, we've been working through this process and listening to Representative Emmer complain about working with the Department of Human Services. And the concerns that he had regarding, and that we have as an industry, of working with companies that have paid large fines to avoid criminal prosecution. In that, and as an industry, one of the other things that we are concerned about is the Department of Human Services oftentimes will go before these legislative committees and talk about how much that they believe, they perceive that there is fraud in the special transportation industry. As a director of an association and as representing the association and our members, you know, we really resent that unfounded statement. There have been no fraud convictions. Nobody has paid substantial fines in our industry. And we have worked with the department over the past few years in efforts to prevent fraud in our industry. And if I could just take a couple minutes and not a short time. One of the things that we did with the industry is we said, you know, one of the ways to prevent fraud is come forward with the chain of custody document. Long and short, if you get a package from FedEx, you sign for it. We went to the department and said, you know, when we transport these vulnerable adults, somebody should sign for it. It does two things. It makes sure that they get there, and it verifies that they have a medical appointment. In working, one of the other things that we've worked with the department is said, you know what, department, this is before the broker came in, we said, enforce your own rules. Make sure that people shouldn't get these services. In doing that, we saved $6 million in 1 year in those two items.
One of the other things we've said to the department is use a computerized mileage system. That will also eliminate any issues, and the department has refrained from that. Our concern was raised regarding MTM, which is a company called Medical Transportation Management, a company out of Missouri. They have paid $2.4 million to the state of Missouri to settle fraud claims, and they also gave up claims on $17 million worth of accounts receivable that they claimed. Some of those accounts receivable included hauling dead people. And what our concern is, when we talked to the department during the RFP process, and we said, look, there's a lot of brokers out there. You know, I think that the first time the RFP went out, there were at least six different companies that bid on it. What we said is, you know what, somewhere somebody's past history should be taken into account. And the department on both RFPs has refused to take into account anybody's prior history. We believe that this is a significant issue, especially since companies, after entering into large settlements, everybody claims there's no liability. One of the things that we've noticed in a recent report from the Kaiser Network, healthcare consultant Robin Mathias said that states oftentimes identify likely fraud months or years after payment by analyzing claims data, but the effort is often too little too late. And if I can just give you a few examples of our concern on the fraud.
Okay, Mr. Ryan, we're really under a deadline here, and I have several other bills, so if it's directly to the bill, I think we're going to have to focus.
It is directly, and if may just... in November of 2006, the Justice Department stated that they recovered a record $3.1 billion in fraud and false claims. 72% of that was in the healthcare industry. That's the concern, and that's where this comes out of. Oftentimes, companies such as Kellogg, Brown & Root, they'll pay $8 million to settle fraud allegations. American Medical Response pays $9 million to settle fraud allegations. That's what this bill is trying to prevent.
Thank you. Representative Emmer, did the department want to come down and address the bill?
I think the department might be here of administration. There might be somebody from the Department of Health as well.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Materials Management Division Director from the Department of Administration. I appreciate what Representative Emmer is attempting to do with the bill, but we really have a number of problems with the bill as drafted, and fear in the form that it's in that it will create more legal, fiscal, and administrative problems than it will resolve. Very briefly, Section 1 provides authority to, or requires us to not contract with particular vendors. We already have the comparable authority in an existing rule, except for the point 4, which would add the companies that have settled for over $1 million. And that's the issue that we had discussed with Representative Emmer, is something that we could and would add to our rule if that was the will of the legislature. We also have some problems with subdivisions 1 and 2 with respect to the language being overly broad. You will see if you, at least as I read it, it doesn't require conviction for all of these things. In some cases, it just requires having committed various acts, including making false statements. So, for example, this would require us to ask our prospective vendors whether they have made any false statements. And even the most honest people on the face of the earth have usually inadvertently made false statements. So we would need to clean up that sort of language to make sure that it was considerably less ambiguous. The concept in Subdivision 2 is fine as it relates to making an affirmative or requiring vendors to make an affirmative response as to whether they've been convicted of certain things. I think it sends a good signal to vendors that the state of Minnesota is interested in doing business with vendors that have a high standard of business integrity. But again, some of it is overly broad, including the instances where it's a much more subjective issue than whether or not there's been a conviction. Our most serious problems would be in Subdivision 3. It requires the cancellation of contracts when we find vendors in particular situations. One of the problems with it is that it would require state agencies to know on the day the bill goes into effect which vendors have engaged in these practices. And in some cases, such as the one that Representative Emmer is describing as having motivated the bill, we might have that information, but in many other cases, we wouldn't have that information immediately. The prospective certification would be our method for identifying other vendors that have, in fact, committed practices of this nature. So although the statute would require us to cancel the contracts immediately, we wouldn't have knowledge as to which contracts are subject to cancellation when the bill goes into effect. There also could be problems for us with respect to canceling with 30 days notice, which is what the bill would have us do. In most cases, we would have the legal authority to do that, but it doesn't mean that you cancel a contract without some fiscal consequences. And in many cases, we would end up having to negotiate settlements ourselves with these vendors if we cancel the contract and they had made various investments and so forth on the basis of the state's representations to them in that contract. Further problem with Subdivision 3 is that it doesn't provide any exception to the process. Under our current rules, the Commissioner of Administration has the authority in exceptional situations to even overrule a debarment. And one would hope that doesn't happen very frequently because, again, we certainly don't choose to be doing business with vendors that are dishonorable or disreputable in any way. But the rule, for example, gives the commissioner authority to overrule debarments in situations if a vendor is the single source of a particular good or service, or if it's found to be in the state's best interest to continue a contract with a vendor, despite the fact that they've engaged in this behavior that's less than honorable. So again, I think there could be fairly serious fiscal and legal consequences of these immediate cancellations. And we would need to do a lot of work on the language of the bill before we could support it and effectively operationalize it.
Mr. Allen, when you say there is a fiscal consequence, are you saying there's a fiscal impact on the department as a result of this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there would be. I mean, we would be canceling contracts. We would have to then engage the Attorney General's office in assisting us in negotiating our way out of those cancellations. There would presumably be some the statute is significantly different enough from our rule so that we would need to amend the rule to conform to the new statute. So yes, there would be fiscal consequences.
Mr. Allen, when you're talking about contracts of this nature, can you give us some idea of the amount that would be involved in these contracts that would be with either the state or other entities?
Mr. Chairman, the dollar amount?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I really wouldn't have a good estimate of the dollar amount. I mean, I would hope there are very few vendors that are in this situation. I mean, we do occasionally debar a vendor following a criminal conviction.
Mr. Allen, I'm only bringing it up. The initial motion here was to send it to the General Registry. And if there is a significant fiscal impact, I'm looking at the sponsor of the bill that perhaps a better place to go might be finance rather than the General Registry, because I think there might be a discussion on the floor on this very topic if it did not go to finance. Representative Emmer.
If you're asking, Mr. Chair, I would disagree with the testifier vehemently, because that begs the question. Are we entering into all kinds of contracts with fraudulent vendors? If we're going to have this huge cost, we got a problem. But that being said, Mr. Chairman, if that is your advice and the desire of the committee, I'll be fine with whatever you suggest.
All right. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, I guess Representative Emmer raises a very good point. How many contracts do we imagine might the state have entered into with fraudulent companies, companies that have been convicted or had situations where they settled out of court in excess of $1 million to avoid fraudulent or fraud convictions in other states? Do we see this as a rampant problem?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I would certainly hope not, and I don't believe so. But as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that would be that I thought would be helpful in the bill is requiring vendors to affirmatively indicate whether or not they have engaged in those or been convicted of engaging in those practices. We don't do that now, so I can't tell you with any certainty how many vendors may have done that. One thing that I am aware of is that a fair number of businesses enter into settlements to avoid costs of litigation, generally don't concede that there's a don't make any admission in doing that there was any sort of violation, but we might be surprised how many major businesses, including some that we think of as highly reputable, have in fact engaged in settlements with public entities for $1 million or more.
Well, Mr. Allen, I guess I'm surprised we're not a little more on top of this in the first place. Certainly, we've known about this broker and their situation for some time now. Representative Emmer has expressed his, I think he put it, dissatisfaction and frustration, or perhaps some slightly stronger words, at this situation. He's been expressing this for quite some time. And yet nothing's been done about it to the degree that we're now pursuing legislation to, it seems to me, force the state government to do something that they ought to have been doing in the first place. I don't understand. I think that when you have a known case of a company that we're using taxpayer dollars to pay them to do a service and provide a service to very vulnerable adults, we know what their background is, and we're okay with that. I'm not okay with that, and that's why I'm very grateful to Representative Emmer and others for bringing this bill forward. And I hear your concerns, but those are concerns I think that this bill is going to address. And I think we should move forward with this bill and allow those things to be addressed, and we need to know. So I guess that's more of a comment than a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Allen, you want to respond, or should we just continue with the question?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a response. I think the Department of Human Services would be in a better position to respond to any specifics regarding that particular contract.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that the things that I heard Mr. Allen say could be fixed in this bill. For example, you can add to a rule by statute so that you don't have, and you can make it clear that then the statute supersede the rule. In the cancellation, and I would suggest that all you'd need is one contract that had to be canceled due to Subdivision 3 to have a very significant fiscal impact with the bill. One could certainly add the proper notification so this is not retroactive in that sense. You know, because it is true that settlements do occur because an attorney says it's easier to settle this than it is to litigate it. And so, I think the bill can be fixed up. I was, as soon as I heard Mr. Allen begin to speak, I was going to suggest that it be laid over until he comes back with some suggested amendments for the bill. I don't think that what he said are insignificant problems.
All right. Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my concern, if I can grab my copy of the bill back from Representative Kahn, is about the fiscal impact, especially with the amendment that we included, including the officers, directors, and beneficial owners, wondering if the department is going to have to monitor settlements and suits across the nation of now not only the specific entities, but actually having to do searches all the time of every officer, director, or beneficial owner. And so I do think that it's a real concern. If Mr. Allen could comment briefly, I think it would be helpful to this committee.
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate your comment. I agree. I mean, the more prescriptive and more detailed our monitoring obligation becomes, the recognizing that we would be doing it for a good cause, it does take resources to do that work.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Emmer.
I do need to respond to that. I disagree strongly. I think Representative Kahn your comments are very well taken. I will point out to you that, again, if we've got a huge problem, this should have been addressed a long time ago. But also, unless it's the state of Minnesota that is providing services and getting paid by an outside entity, please keep in mind if there is a contract that is canceled, it would mean savings that would then have to be reapportioned to whatever the need is. I'm sure people can make arguments either way. If finance is where that should be addressed, that's wonderful. Laying it over, I don't think, is a good idea because of the two things. One, your issue on settlements. One of the reasons that the threshold is so high is so we don't run into the situation where it's less expensive to go forward. The reason you pay $1 million or more, I would suggest to you, is because you've got significant liability problems, and it's going to be both the cost of defending and the potential penalties and loss. Second, Representative Kalin, when it comes to monitoring, I think everybody's misinterpreted, and I think with all due respect to Mr. Allen, he's taken us down this road that suggests that his department is going to have to be the watchdog out there. Keep in mind that when you have a competitive bidding process, I will guarantee you that if there is someone that is fraudulent and doing business in this state with the state of Minnesota and there are other competitors looking at the situation, they will report it. And in fact, I think Mr. Allen will tell you that that's in fact what happens now with requested debarments. So the public will be the watchdog.
Representative Emmer, given the time here, I would suggest that you withdraw the initial motion to send this to the General Registry, and then your motion should be that this should go to the Finance Committee with the understanding that there is financial work that has to be done on this bill and clarification.
Motion is withdrawn and renewed in the form that the Chair suggests.
All right. So, members, the new motion is then Representative moves that House File 729 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. And Representative Volschweiger had a question.
Okay, Chair members, I just wanted to compliment you, Representative Emmer. This is, comes across as a common sense bill that people on the street in Minnesota would say, you know, for Pete's sakes, if they can't vote for this, what can they vote for? So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, with all the compliments, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I won't come back tomorrow.
Representative Emmer, we may have a couple more minutes if we have one more person to come down and testify. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Reisdorf from the Department of Human Services, and we do oppose some parts of this bill, particularly the fourth issue in Subdivision 3. Our concerns are that the canceling of contracts does not require an allegation or conviction or court judgment in these cases. And that has been said before, people settle financial disputes all the time. So this would affect a number of contracts that the department has. There seems to be one particular contract in mind in this part of the bill, and that's our contract for medical transportation. In the case of the company that we do contract with, there has not been any accusation of fraud or fraud being found in the case of this company. We could give, there's been some other states, other kinds of things brought up. We could give this committee some specifics as to what has happened in other states with this company. But with the state of Missouri, there was a contract interpretation issue, and that's where the settlement came into play. There was never an allegation of fraud or fraud found in the case of this company. And I just wanted to clarify a point is that in the medical transportation area, we have had several cases of convictions of fraud from the Attorney General's office and numerous settlements in the case of transportation companies paying back the department for improper billing. But I want to mention that if we had to cancel this contract with a 30-day notice, it would take us about 6 months or more to redo that, and there could be some disruption in the medical transportation services. And approximately 50,000 plus calls that are now coming into our contractor would then have to go back to the counties and to provide services for access transportation. Other contracts that may be affected by this bill is that it may affect our ability to cover many drugs. Pfizer and other pharmaceutical companies settle claims with the federal government and states all the time, and so this would compromise our ability to cover many, many drugs in the medical assistance program. We also have a contract with a company that gives us a pharmacy database on a monthly basis, and this inability to have this contract or to discontinue this contract would cause major problems in our ability to pay pharmacy claims. There may also be some issues with health plan contracts, hospital contracts, and other kinds of contracts that may have been settled $4 million or more. So we would also have to take a look to see what other kinds of contracts may be affected by this bill.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Reinsdorf. Members, any further questions? Seeing no further questions, then Representative Emery renews his motion that House File 729, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Emery. Members, we're very pressed. I'm going to select, I hope, what will be a very brief bill, House File 1608, Representative Bigham. It's a Secretary of State bill that she has told me that is actually a real housekeeping bill and has no controversy in it whatsoever.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Emmer.
Are we going to be discussing the difference between loitering and lingering again?
I would hope, Representative Emmer, I intend to discuss that the rest of this session. It's a significant issue, and I want it resolved before we adjourn. So,
Mr. Chair, just Representative for the record, Representative Lilly would not let me use the Winona State pen that he has there. Be familiar with Winona State, sir?
Representative Bigham, more than you know.
All right. That makes two of us.
Representative Bigham, I'm going to move that House File 1608 be recommended to pass. And Representative Bigham, where should this go?
I believe it should go to State Government Finance. Representative
Bigham, I'm going to recommend that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance, because what goes into Finance comes down eventually. We don't know where.
Sounds good.
That's where we're going to do it. So, Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one verbal or oral amendment to delete Sections 3 and 5, and Mr. Burt Black from the Secretary of State's office can talk about that as a discussion with the other folks.
Well, there's no sense discussing something we're going to delete. Okay. Once it's out of here, it's out of here. So I'm going to move that amendment. Mr. Shepard, what exactly am I moving? I'm deleting sections what?
3 and 5.
3 and 5. I'm going to move the deletion of those two sections. All those in favor signify by...
They're articles.
Then I'm going to wait for a second. Representative Shepard, what am I deleting?
Mr. Chair, there's two articles in the bill. So is Mr. Black or Ms. Bigham, Representative Bigham, is it Article 1, Section
1.
3 and
yes.
5? Okay.
I'm sorry, Article 1, Section 3 and 5.
Mr. Shepard, do you have those?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. I'm going to move that those be deleted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? All right. Representative Bigham, your bill should be in order.
All right. This is a business housekeeping bill, and I'll turn it for the Secretary of State's office. I will turn it over to Mr. Burt Black.
Mr. Black, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Burt Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. There are, as Mr. Shepard noted, two articles in this bill. This is our business services housekeeping bill in Article 1. Article 2 relates to notaries, and these are provisions that were brought to us by the real property section of the State Bar Association. I'll very briefly go through Article 1. Basically, this Article 1 is to bring consistency to the practices and to the laws relating to certain business entity filings. The assumed name fee is to bring the fee in line with the other fees we charge for copies. Section 2, the business corporation annual report makes it clear that it's 1 year, missing 1 year, not 2 years, will subject the corporation to what is the existing resolution of that for all businesses, which is an administrative dissolution, which businesses can be reinstated from. We have a number of provisions on cooperatives, improving the cooperative law in sections 4, 6, and 7. We have a provision, a very interesting provision, repealing something special that was passed in the 80s. I think Representative Kahn, you may remember Representative Bob Hawkes. He had a provision in here for volunteer firefighter relief associations, but with our new online filings, we've made the arrangement that was had with the state auditor unnecessary. We provide for a reduction in fees for name reservations for foreign limited partnerships. We provide three sections relating to the Uniform Commercial Code, one of which has to do with the equalization of a fee. We had a discount fee for about 3 years, but it was undercutting the counties, and that necessitates this bill going to Representative Kahn's committee as well. And then we have a further repealer on the Volunteer Firefighter Associations. With respect to the notaries, the basic thrust of the notary sections is to permit limited liability companies to sign in a representative capacity, and also to make sure that there is a difference between verifying and attesting a notarial act versus acknowledging, that the notary needs to be present when witnessing, attesting, or verifying the notarization, but that for acknowledgments, which is more common, that the notary need not be present when the signature is made, that the person simply need to identify themselves at the time the acknowledgment is made. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for further questions.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I congratulate Mr. Black for a new term, fee equalization. That's an interesting term. My question, Mr. Chairman, is on page 2. Mr. Black, you said this section, subdivision 4 of section 2, was for the purposes of consistency. Can you just explain that to me a little bit more?
Mr. Black.
Yes. Other business entities, for example, limited liability companies, file an annual report. The business corporations also file an annual report. The other business entities are dissolved after they miss one calendar year. This provision was in place. It provides the old provision. The current provision says you have to miss 2 years as a business corporation. However, this provision was enacted before we had our online filing. The online filing, we do about 185,000 annual reports every year, and about 85% of them are done online. The online filing takes about 30 seconds. It's an excellent tool, and it has removed a lot of the onerous aspects of what used to be a paper filing, and that the onerous aspect was why there was a desire to have the businesses miss 2 years. But now that we have the online filing, and everybody gets notice that they should go to the web and make their filing online, because it's actually quite convenient for both the business and for us. It seems like it's time to go to the same rule that we have for all the other entities. We don't want to have a difference in policy between the entities. And actually, we are now doing more limited liability companies. We do about 18,000 of those a year, and those are subject to the 1 year already in Chapter 322B, similar provision, as opposed to business corporations. We do about 12,000 of those new ones a year, and so those are under this other rule. And so we're trying to get that to be the same rule for businesses and LLCs.
Any further questions? Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering, Mr. Black, is there an additional fee then they would have to pay because they're filing annually? And then my second question is, do businesses get noticed before they're dissolved?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, there is no fee for annual reports. Okay. So that's a free service. In terms of the notice comes in the form of there is a postcard that they get each year reminding them to file and indicating that if they don't file, that they would be dissolved.
Any further questions? Representative Winkler.
No,
not on this?
Nothing.
right. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, I'm looking at page 7, 7.1, and it's talking about adding a fee of $35 for a foreign limited partnership. Can you tell me how the Secretary of State's office came to that amount?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, actually, this is on page 7.1?
Yes.
If you look at lines 7.23 and 4 below, if you don't specify a fee, the fee is $50. So this actually is a reduction from 50 to 35.
Mr.
Representative Anderson.
I understand that. What I'm asking is why that amount? Why? I'll tell you a little background information. In a different committee, I'd asked the Mr. Secretary of why the Secretary of State's office comes to these certain fee amounts, and his response was, well, because it's set in statute. Leaving out the part that you guys come to us and ask for these fee amounts. So I'm asking for what is the logic and reasoning, why $35 and not $5?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the $35 is, first of all, the $35 is the equivalent of what the other name reservation fee is. And that's why we've got this provision in at all, is to make sure that there's consistency between that. $35 is frankly, it's a retail price point that was set by this legislature in 1989 or 1991. I think 1989. I can tell you that that's a fee that was set by the legislature. I've been at Secretary of State a long time, but I can't tell you the details of what happened in 1989.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Black, perhaps you could give me greater detail of why it is that your office needs $35 to make these different, to perform these functions. What exactly is this money going for? How much is the actual cost of performing these services per individual?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, this money goes to the general fund. The Secretary of State's office does not receive this money.
Okay.
I can tell you that in a biennium, I believe our budget is somewhere in the neighborhood of, is it six? I think six. Representative Kahn probably knows better than I.
Well,
$6 million, and we bring in about $24 million.
I realize that it is a significant question, but this is the policy committee. This is going to finance, so those questions can be handled at finance and then in Representative Kahn's division.
Mr. Chair, if you can prepare your office to answer this question, because I didn't get answered when it was in a different realm in a finance committee. If you can just prepare your office for that, because I'll be asking that question.
Mr. Chair.
And not just say, well, it was set back in the 80s and that's what the legislature, because I'm assuming that at that time, too, the office came forward and said, well, we recommend this amount.
Representative Anderson, I see the Secretary of State's office in the audience, and I did receive an affirmative facial gesture.
And then
you would be getting that information.
Representative Anderson, I'll make sure that gets to you before the committee, actually.
Well, I'm hoping that the Secretary of State's office will, too, Representative Bingham. All right. Any further questions to this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of I'll renew my motion that House File 1608, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Members, if you would save in your packets things we have not dealt with so we don't have to reinsert them, that's getting to be a lot of work for everyone to do it. We'll pick up where we left off tomorrow, and with that, the meeting is adjourned.